welcome to my episode of the Film Magazine's Most Romantic Movie Moments podcast miniseries. My name's Katie, I'm one of the deputy editors and content creators for thefilmmagazine.com, and today I would like to share with you what I think is one of the most romantic moments committed to cinema. So, you know, my involvement with the ever-exciting thefilmmagazine.com does portray the fact that cinema is more than just a hobby to me. In fact, I would say a few select moments from film have heralded in very key milestones in my life. The Lord of the Rings trilogy, for example, gifted me with a very unexpected emotional maturing. You know, I witnessed this epic battle between good and evil. And then when the story had ended, my 10-year-old self was bereft. It was hard to say goodbye to these characters. It was like a real lesson in loss and grief. At 16, my concept of adult themes in cinema was completely challenged and then expanded upon when I was shown The Graduate for the first time. Up until that point, most of the mature content I had seen was sort of stereotypical, crude, gross-out comedy, you know, like Borat. But you know, after watching Mike Nichols' masterpiece, I was more than ready to properly explore these serious challenges of adulthood in film, in a way that then helped to prepare me to face them in real life. And then in adulthood, there were films like 2001 A Space Odyssey, Cloud Atlas. They all helped to form actual coherent life philosophy. So all in all, not to be cheesy, I would say film has helped me to become a better person. So amongst all of this, where do I actually stand on romance? I mean, in all honesty, I'm not a hugely romantic individual. If you asked anyone who knows me, they would probably say the same thing. That's not to say that I don't believe in the power of love. And I also think that romantic relationships and encounters is one of the most intense ways to experience this emotion, concept, whatever you want to label love. But when it comes to the more great romances from cinema and Hollywood, I'm probably ever slightly on the side of the fence that sneers at them. You know, not too much, just a little bit. But, you know, to totally eat my words now, I'm going to have to admit that my favourite movie of all time is Powell and Pressburger's romantic war epic from 1946, A Matter of Life and Death. And it is this film that I'll be taking the romantic moment to discuss with you all now. A Matter of Life and Death is actually an excellent example of a film that is greater than the sum of its parts. It was originally intended as propaganda to bolster Anglo-American relationships in the aftermath of the Second World War. But this delightful fantasy has instead inspired and influenced some of Hollywood's greatest figures, such as Martin Scorsese, and on a more sort of ordinary, everyday way, I think it's a film that deeply impacts anyone who stumbles upon it. So the film actually begins with an ambiguous text scroll, you know, just like in Star Wars, informing us that the story we are about to see is one of two worlds, the one we know, and another which only exists in the mind of a young airman whose life and imagination have been violently shaped by war. And then this message ends with a little cheeky wink to the audience as it says, any resemblance to any other world, known or unknown, is purely coincidental. So the story actually begins with what I would describe as the Night Air of Europe, May 1945, and you can hear that it's brimming with life, with transmissions and messages sipping over great distances over the sea, and it focuses in on one transmission, and it's an American radio operator, and she's trying to contact an ailing Lancaster bomber aircraft that's returning from a night raid in Europe. June, our fair radio operator, all she's getting in response are these cryptic poetic quotes from the pilot, Peter Carter. And from this, a deep but playful conversation ensues about life and love, but it then takes a sad turn as it becomes clear that Peter knows that he's doomed. The aircraft's been devastated by a shell attack, his parachute's been ripped to shreds. He plans to jump to his death from the aircraft rather than frying alive in it. And it's through this brief encounter in these awful circumstances that the most profound connection between Peter and June is formed, and it's just devastatingly cut short as then Peter jumps out of his plane. Or so we thought! The morning after, a bedraggled but remarkably chipper Peter finds himself washed up on a beach. He actually thinks he's arrived to the place where you come to after death, and it's only after conversation with the goat herd that he realises the miracle that he's still alive. And even better, that he still has a shot with June, who he runs off to go find. And the pair reunite, and of course, after that conversation on the radio, they just fall completely and helplessly deeply in love. But you know, nothing's ever simple in romance, is it? Peter's lucky escape doesn't go amiss. In fact, it turns out it's upset some clogs, which you could say exist on a different realm of existence. There's an invoice for Peter, which has been left unfinished and has now caused a misbalance in the books. So a conductor, Conductor 71, who is actually supposed to meet Peter when he jumped out of the plane, but he missed him in the fog, is sent down to then convince Peter to be delivered to this new world so as to fix this accounting error. But after having met in June, Isoko refuses Conductor 71, who then, you know, tries to counter with the fact of how many people who die are in love. Peter then says, well, it's due to the failure of Heron's soul delivery service that he actually had the opportunity to meet June and then wants to spend the rest of his life with her. He actually says, I've fallen in love because of your mistake. I'm in an entirely different position that I was in last night. Then I expected to die, I was ready to die, and it wasn't my fault that I didn't, it was yours. So Peter's rather an articulate guy. He manages to request an appeal, but of course, this does come with the dread of the worst case scenario of him losing his case and then having to say goodbye to June. And to make matters worse, it's become apparent that Peter is suffering from some sort of mystery affliction. He's plagued with these excruciating headaches. His vision keeps on being blurry. And of course, his hallucinations. No one else can see Conductor 71. That's only Peter. With the help of a local village doctor, Dr. Reed, who's actually a secret neurological expert, June helps Peter in preparing him to win his case, but his physical condition is rapidly deteriorating to the point that he's actually going to need urgent brain surgery. June and the doctor worry that if Peter loses his case, which, as far as they're concerned, is a figment of his imagination, he'll die. So the actual great romantic moment comes at the very pinnacle of Peter's trial, conveniently conducted at the exact same time as his surgery. So the jury say that they wish to hear from Peter and June themselves before deciding their fate. And you know, that brings Peter and June together for what may be the last time. And what has been the ongoing issue with this case is them having to face against a pretty severe prosecution counsel by the name of Abraham Farlon. Now, this is actually based on a real guy. He was the first American killed by a British bullet in the American War of Independence. And apparently he's quite disgusted at the idea of this young American woman being seduced by this British airman. To him, this is just mere infatuation, the love of the moment, rather than any actual long-lasting love for each other. In typical Powell and Presbyter style, A Matter of Life and Death walks the tightrope between drama and lightheartedness. And it's also compounded with the fact that the actual writing, directing, producing duo did some pretty thorough medical research into this. So Peter's plight actually does resound with true life, despite its very fantastical nature. So although there is an almost desperation in the relationship between Peter and June, very much two souls finding solace in each other amongst what was the last leg of a terrible, devastating war, Peter does occasionally feign a sort of playful facetiousness, you know, commenting on another woman's legs on one occasion. But this is most likely to guard his growing vulnerability in the face of his burgeoning feelings for June and the worry over his apparent hallucinations. This also British flippancy comes out in full force in the face of authority that is Abraham Farlon. You know, who is he to question something so deeply intimate and personal and private? And it's only dropped when Farlon then tries to trick June into replacing Peter on the balance sheet. At this point, he doesn't care about his own life, which is now probably forfeited by his contempt of court. But now he only cares about June's life. And then to his horror, their own defence counsel, the village doctor, Dr. Reeves, who was helping Peter and June before, who actually perished in a motorbike accident when he was fetching an ambulance for Peter, he then suggests the same thing as Abraham Farlon, that June replaces Peter in the balance book so as to prove their love. This moment is genuinely horrible. All that Peter and June have suffered together was for the sake of them actually staying together. Peter was brought to the point of near death, worrying himself over who to pick for his defence counsel. So at this point, the love between June and Peter can't be denied. And we're now facing heartbreak as June and Peter are being pulled apart from each other. June's self-sacrifice in particular is just so moving, and she just does it without hesitation. I mean, compared to Peter's guarded behaviour, she's so honest about her feelings, and she just steps onto the stairway to heaven with no hesitation if it means saving Peter's life. She just turns back, gives him one last watery smile, says goodbye, and then the stairway starts pulling away from her life and from Peter. But within seconds, the stairway to heaven just suddenly lurches to a stop. In fact, it like nearly dislodges the entire trial. And this is the opportunity in which June just pelts away down the staircase and runs back into Peter's arms. All the while, whilst Dr. Reeves, who'd been planning this the entire time, says, "Yes, Mr. Farland, nothing is stronger than the law in the universe, but on Earth, nothing is stronger than love." Ugh, it's cheesy, but man, this film is all about hope and darkness, and despite the grandiosity of this fantastical film, it's just a celebration of the ordinary hope that in this life we will be able to find the love that will sustain us, and hopefully in the next life as well. Too many times have we seen great romances in cinema end in a bittersweet tragedy because the love wasn't meant to be. Well, screw that. Peter and June's love spits in the face of the laws of the universe, you know, the very thermodynamics and kinetics on the subatomic level, and they still win. Peter and June's love is so great that they will throw away their lives for each other, and they still win. They both get to live. Their love for each other physically halts the machinations of the higher power that dominates their lives, and they still win. And is that not what we all love? A love that allows us to overcome anything? All tyranny in this life and the next is ultimately overcome by love. And even more in this day and age, we have to try and find the motivation that lets us defeat the darkness. I've never seen a film like A Matter of Life and Death before, and I'm pretty sure I never will. But I don't think I need to, as this film is always going to be my cure against cynicism, and it's my number one reminder of what is the power of love.